Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
It's Memorial Day weekend. For most of us, that means the official beginning of summer. We break out the motorboat, grill up some burgers, bust out a keg of beer, and enjoy the three-day weekend with some friends on a lake. However, the real purpose of Memorial Day is to remember our nation's soldiers who have died in battle. It originated as Decoration Day shortly after the Civil War as a way to commemorate both Union and Confederate soldiers who fell during our nation's bloodiest conflict. While traditionally celebrated on May 30th, a congressional act in 1968 moved this holiday to the last Monday in May to accommodate a three-day weekend. One of the things I try to do with this podcast is connect special days of the year with a thematic discussion. I've done that with our past three shows that appear on the 4th of July, looking at religion in colonial American history, and I've also been pretty good at getting thematic shows scheduled for Thanksgiving, Christmas, Halloween, and Tax Day. For the past year, I've been wanting to learn more about the military chaplaincy, and I figured that there would be no better date to schedule that interview for than the Memorial Day weekend. So here we are. I'm extremely pleased to have with me today Chaplain Robert Canoon, who is currently serving in the U.S. Army and stationed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Washington State. Major Canoon came to my attention via my good friend Lois Gustafson, who was my civilian platoon leader, so to speak, for sending care packages to soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan for the past decade. Lois, who runs what I would consider to be a major care package operation out of her rural Washington home, stays in touch with lots of soldiers in our region and frequently interacts with chaplains in order to figure out what the needs of various soldiers are. I've been honored to be a small part of Lois's care package platoon and salute her efforts over the years as she is the perfect exemplar of what the term Christian charity should be. Other than knowing that Lois has had contact with Chaplain Canoon, I know little else about him, so my introduction to him is rather brief. But that is the point of today's show, to learn about who goes into the military chaplaincy and what those chaplains do on a day-to-day and year-to-year basis. I should note at the outset that we will not be dealing with a particular controversy that has arisen recently regarding proselytization in the military. I do this first because, as an official member of the U.S. Army, this would put Major Canoon in a difficult position commenting on official policy. Moreover, though, there has been a great deal of discussion about that controversy in the news. The goal of this podcast is not to discuss current events per se. There are plenty of radio shows, TV shows, and blogs that can do that. Instead, I would merely like to take a deeper look at what a military chaplain does as a way of providing more informed discussion for others on those contemporary and somewhat controversial topics. That is our general goal here on Research on Religion, to dig deeper, more so than what news outlets usually do, and we hope you understand our position and have patience with us in that regard. With that said, Robert, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Hey, first off, how do I address you? I called you Roger for a minute. I know I'm not supposed to do that because that's not your name. But do I say Major, Mr., Sir, Reverend, Most Pontifical? What do I call you? I don't want to break any Army protocol here.
Well, I'll tell you what, Sonny. I would answer to most of those.
Okay.
Even to Roger, interestingly enough, that was my father's name.
Oh, okay.
But typically it would be chaplain.
Oh, typically chaplain. So now you are a major in the Army. So when soldiers address you, do they call you chaplain or they call you major? Is that the issue that comes up?
Well, with most officers, they would address you by your rank or sir. But in the chaplaincy, we try to focus more on our role as a religious leader with that pastoral touch. And so officially, it's just chaplain, no matter what our rank is.
Okay. That'll be interesting, because I think later on we're going to talk about how you interact with the different ranks within the military, and there might be different ways or things that you have to do. So that's I'm always interested in that, those how we call people what we call them. I'm also curious, and I would guess most of our listeners would be as well, about what motivates someone to become a chaplain in the military. Mm. I mean, when most people think about the military, we think about some sergeant getting all gunned up and heading off to battle. And then when we think about a chaplain, we tend to think of somebody who's preaching peace and love, love thy neighbor kind of stuff from the pulpit. It just seems like an interesting intersection between those two diverse worlds. Mm. So let's go ahead and start off our discussion with your background. I do this with many of my guests. And so let's start with you being raised as a kid. Did you grow up in a religious family?
Well, you know, I did. I was adopted into a Christian family. I was born in Seattle, and then through Lutheran Social Services, adopted by my parents, Roger and Diane Canoon, and raised in Spokane, Washington, in a Christian family with an older brother or older sister and a younger sister.
So you're a Washington native, so to speak.
I am.
And yeah. Did you get to kind of choose the area that you ended up with, or is it just fortuitous that you're still here at Lewis McChord?
You know, it was a blessing. Yeah, fortuitous blessing to be here in Spokane, so close to home.
Okay. So your family, you were adopted through Lutheran services, and your family was fairly religious. Did you guys go to church regularly, or...?
We did. We attended a Presbyterian church, Opportunity Presbyterian in Spokane, Washington, and all the way through high school, we attended there, and that's actually where my wife and I were married.
Oh, well, there you go. That works out well, too. Were your parents or any other relatives you had in the military?
My dad was. He was in the Navy, and he was a Navy cook, and so many things about him growing up stemmed off of his the discipline that he learned in the Navy, and you know, and the cook part came out too, because when he'd get off from work early, he was a professor at a college in Spokane, he would come home and bake bread or bake cinnamon rolls, and it was always a pure joy to come home to that.
Well, that must have been great. Did he bake them in mass, like for 700 soldiers on or sailors on an aircraft carrier? I mean, that'd be cool.
Reduce the amount for the family.
Okay, it is. You know, sometimes you get those army cooks that they don't know how to cook for anybody other than 700 people at a time or something.
Right.
Yeah. Were you one of those kids that was interested then in the military? I mean, you said your dad was in the Navy, and so you had that contact with it. You know, I was one of those kids. My father was in the Air National Guard, and I had a lot of uncles who served in both the Navy and the Army. And I was also one of those kids that loved to play with the plastic soldiers on the, you know, dirt pile in the backyard or something like that. Growing up, did you have that kind of interest in the military?
You know, I grew up in a family that was hunters. You know, we were hunting and fishing. And so some of those connections with living off the land and hunting was there, but not once, all the way through junior high and high school, not once did I ever see myself in the military.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, I got a teenager right now too. I don't think he sees himself much past next week. So, but you probably got older, and as you got into high school, you start thinking, okay, I'm going to graduate. What's going to happen?
Yep.
Did you start to think about college? Did you start thinking about other career paths, the military, the seminary? What was your thought process around that 17, 18-year-old period of your life?
Well, I think it sums up in a quote that I put in my high school yearbook, Central Valley High School, and I put in there, "Now the gates of life are opened wide, and we step through." You know, so I think at some point in my senior year, I started thinking about what's on the other side of high school, you know, what's the next chapter of this life? And so I started going to college at the community college. But once I signed up in that summer between high school and college, my dad, I was 18, he passed away. And so that really started really getting me thinking about life and death. And what's all these things I've learned going to church, are they real or are they not real? And so I really dove into some grieving and some deep thinking.
And so was it at that moment that you thought, maybe the seminary is something for me, I might want to go down a career path in that, or did you continue on with college just with these questions?
Well, I think I worked through it for a couple years at the community college, and as I started getting near my AA degree, ROTC became very interesting to me. And I thought, what's a way that I could honor my dad? And so ROTC was my next step, and so I went out to Eastern Washington University and joined the Army as a cadet.
Okay. The Eastern Washington Eagles, if I'm correct.
Yes, correct. Yes.
And they are known for having a red football field.
They are.
Yeah. Did they have a red football field at the when you were there?
They did. Yep.
Yeah, okay. I know Boise State has a blue one. They have this bright red one, and I've tried watching a few Eastern Washington games, and my eyes get a little bit tired after a while. But so you're Eastern Washington Eagle, mm-hmm. and you're there in the ROTC program. Now, when you're in the ROTC, were they tracking you one direction? They say, oh, you look like an infantry guy, so we're going to send you there, or you're our artillery or something along that lines. Or it was at this time where you're starting to form – hey, maybe I could put these two paths of my life together in the military chaplaincy.
You know, that is a very unique situation. First off, they just train everybody in infantry tactics.
Mm-hmm.
So you're learning about leadership in the military as a future officer through infantry tactics and putting you through tests and challenging situations. But I didn't dive right into that. First off, they sent me to Fort Knox, Kentucky, because ROTC is usually a four-year program, and back in 1990, they were still offering a two-year scholarship. So, because I had my A degree, I had to fly down to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and go through ROTC boot camp and compete for a scholarship. And so that was kind of my first taste, my first entry into military life.
Okay, and I'm sure that. When you were going through boot camp, were you thinking about the chaplaincy? I know a lot of guys go through boot camp and they start all of a sudden praying to God that they're going to get through boot camp. So are things starting to form? And I guess what I'm leading at here with a question is, where does it pop into your head that say, hey, you know what, I'm going to do the chaplaincy?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I was in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and we were going through all the training, and on occasion we'd have a chaplain show up. We'd be out in the field, and the first time I met a chaplain, it was actually a chaplain and a chaplain candidate, and the drill instructors had us all lined up and seated, and the medics were checking our feet.
Mm-hmm.
And the medic would go by, and then as we got our feet checked, then the chaplain was following behind them, and as we were putting our boots on, then they were getting a couple of moments of just talking with us. You know, how you doing, where you from, what could I be praying for you? And that was my first eye-opening experience to, oh, there are chaplains in the military, and here's kind of what they do.
Hmm.
And so it was a slow process of me starting to say, you know, that's pretty wonderful, but not yet had I said that's something that I feel called to.
That is interesting, because I think most people who go into the military don't think there's chaplains there. I mean, if you sit down and you think about it, yeah, we know that there's going to be chaplains there. We hear about it, but it's not going in through that door into the barracks and, oh, there's going to be chaplains around. So that is rather interesting. So now take us to that point where you make that turn. So, you meet this chaplain just after putting your boots on and having the feet checked. And by the way, why were they checking your feet?
Well, we had just done a ruck march, and, you know, many people who are just entering the military, maybe they're not as built up and prepared for such things, and so a lot of people are getting blisters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we train our Boy Scouts about that, but, yeah, a lot of people don't know that. So you meet this chaplain, and now take us to the point where you make that decision, saying, this is going to be my path.
Okay, over the next few weeks in boot camp, there were times where they would come and do field services with us, and it wasn't always the same chaplain. In fact, many times it was different chaplains. The field services, just walking through some scripture and some prayer, and I was so encouraged every time that happened. And then there was a weekend where they said, all right, there's a prayer breakfast this morning. If you want to go, you know, it's time to get ready to go. And then some people were getting ready to go, and I was laying there, and they said, well, the rest of you are going to be scrubbing scrubbing the latrine and scrubbing the floors and waxing. And I saw that motivated me.
Amen. Yeah.
I'm now a motivated guy. And it got me up and got me going. And so I went to the prayer breakfast, and I realized at this prayer breakfast where we had a guest speaker talking to us and encouraging us and prayer, that this was something important, and it was something that maybe I wanted to be a part of. And so I took that glimmer of hope back to ROTC after I graduated boot camp, and went back. And as we got through our first year of ROTC, it was just kind of I was an MS3, military student, third year. And at the end of it, you get to pick your top 10, your top 10 branches that you might want to go into. And so I thought, well, I could add chaplaincy onto that. Well, in 1992, you couldn't. 1991 is when I was making that list, and you couldn't. You couldn't add that yet. So I didn't. It dropped off my radar. And I put engineers up there, and I was actually an SMP cadet, which means simultaneous membership. And so I was drilling with an engineer unit, and they asked me to come back to them once I got my commission, and so I did. And I was actually an engineer officer for 12, 13 years.
Wow. Okay, so you weren't... So there's a gap here, and this is kind of interesting. And I want to pause for a minute, because when you were going through boot camp, and you know the chaplains were coming by, they did it when you were checking feet, and then they did it out in the field when you guys were out there, and then the prayer breakfast. Did you look around at other soldiers and kind of look at how they were reacting to this, or is that something that you really didn't notice?
You know, I did notice, at least at the beginning of the prayer breakfast for sure, that people were not sure what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is this all about? What's going on, you know? Even for people who'd grown up in the church like myself. You know, the way this meshes with the military is so important, but I think that there's that initial curiosity of how's this going to work?
Mm-hmm.
And so it does work, and it works well. But yeah, I noticed in myself and maybe in the people just in my local surrounding, you know, what's going to take place. Now, when we were lined up and they were having our feet checked, and, you know, what wonderful timing to have a chaplain follow right behind. But, you know, chaplains are officers. And so as a cadet, I think some of the things I noticed in myself and the people on my right and left was, you know, what do I call you? It's kind of like what you opened this whole show up with. what do I call you? And so the chaplain candidate told me, this chaplain candidate, you know, and so we try to keep it very simple and comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're in the engineering group for 12 years or so. Mm-hmm. Did you see any deployments at that time? Were you in the Balkans? Were you sent out for the Iraq in the early 2000s? Because that would put you, you know, roughly 2003, 2004, you were in the engineering still?
I was.
Okay, so were you deployed anywhere?
I wasn't. No, in 2004, I was the commander of Bravo Company out of Hayden Lake, and we received a warning order that we were to put everybody who was E7 and above, which is a sergeant first class and above, or O3, captain and above, on orders, and that we were going to backfill a unit that was going into Iraq. And so I got some time with my battalion commander and said, "Sir, you know I'm planning on going into the chaplain corps." And he said, "Not until this is over, Captain Canoon."
Yeah.
So he reminded me of my position and my duty, and I accepted it. And then about 2 weeks later, not quite 2 weeks later, we were told to stand down, that all those positions backfilling that unit had been filled from the IRR.
Which is what?
Inactive Ready Reserve.
Okay. Yeah, you guys use so many acronyms here, I might have to stop you at times. So at that point in time, you were thinking about going into the chaplaincy.
I was.
Area. So where does this start changing? You said you're 12 years as an engineer. Is it happening in your 10th year, 11th year? Are you starting to think about, okay, what's next for me? Lead us through that mental process.
Yes, absolutely. I was in my office. I was the executive officer of Bravo Company, and the battalion chaplain came in and talked to me. His name was Chaplain Lang, and he came in and talked to me, and we had a wonderful conversation about, have you ever thought about becoming a chaplain? Because whenever he couldn't make it down to our unit, he had asked me if I would cover down and run like a Bible study and do things like that for him, which I was pleased to do and enjoyed it. And at some point, he felt like like the Holy Spirit had told him to talk to me. And so he did, and my spirit leapt at this conversation. And so when we were done with the conversation, he made me promise him I would look into it, and he prayed with me. And a couple days later, I called a recruiter, a chaplain recruiter, and God opened all the doors.
Wow. So leading up to that time, too, you must have been active in prayer circles or going to regular services that you did catch the attention of Chaplain Lang. And so is that basically what you were? You were still pretty active. Were you more active in religious services than you were, say, in high school or at Eastern Washington when you were in the military at that point?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I think the more the Army matured me, and the more that being married and a husband and a father, those things matured me, I desired more, and my faith was able to strengthen me and help me give more to the people that needed it, my wife, my kids, the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, my faith had grown quite a bit.
Okay. So your faith is growing. It's apparent to other folks. Chaplain Lang comes to you and says, you know, you got to think about this career path. Let's sit down and pray about this. You say, okay, let's do it. The doors get open. What do you do next? How do you prepare to become a military chaplain? I mean, do you take some seminary classes? What's going on here?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of educational requirements, but, you know, since I was already an Army officer, I kind of crossed the hurdle in a lot of those requirements, especially at the bachelor's level. But the next level is what they're primarily looking for in the Army chaplaincy is a Master's of Divinity. And so that's a minimum typically of 72 hours of graduate hours, and I started mine off at LaSalle University.
And by 72 hours, they don't actually mean just the 72 hours you do it over a weekend or something like that. You actually mean 72 credit hours, right?
72 credit hours.
Yeah, okay, which is more than just a long weekend. Yeah. So, you're taking a lot of classes at LaSalle, and that's in Pennsylvania somewhere, right?
Oh, correction. Yeah, that was when I was studying earlier on my Master's of Psychology.
Oh, okay.
That was LaSalle. But my Master of Divinity is from Golden State School of Theology.
Okay, Golden State. Okay, so let me ask you, when you're in the going to LaSalle for the psychology degree, and then Golden State, what was it again?
Golden State School of Theology.
School of Theology. Did you meet folks who were becoming psychologists and becoming pastors who weren't going into the military? And did these people kind of stare at you and say, what are you doing? You're a military guy. You're all gunned up. What are you doing in the chaplaincy for?
You know, no, I didn't bump into that. I think the only time I bumped into anything similar to that was I served for a while as a sheriff chaplain.
Mm-hmm.
And when they realized that I had a degree in psychology and also a degree in theology, they were kind of curious how those two mesh. And so I just told them that I know the number one psychologist.
Yeah.
God himself. So yeah. We're able to reconcile those.
Oh, yeah. Very good. Yeah, I just mentioned that, too, because I went to my graduate training. I did. One of my friends was in the Army at the time. Uh-huh. And you know, he was kind of the odd cat out, right? He was, you know, what's the Army guy doing here? But he was also one of the fastest ones through because he had the most discipline. So you did a psychology degree and an MDiv. Now, was the psychology degree also required for the chaplaincy service?
It wasn't, no.
Okay.
I was working at a group home with troubled teens. And so I wanted to continue to grow in those areas to help them.
Okay. So now, This brings me to some other questions. This is kind of interesting that you spent 12 years in the regular military before being the chaplaincy, because I, you know, my image, and I, again, I didn't have much info on you prior to this, was that, you know, you just entered. So I want to be a chaplain. I want to go into the military. So the question that I have, and you get to know other chaplains, you interact with them in the military, I would assume, Is that a similar career path for other chaplains? Do they come from the military, or do some of them say when they're 18, 19, 20 years old, they say, hey, I'm going to go get my college degree, then I'm going to go to seminary, and boom, I want to go into the military. Is there a job opening there?
You know, Tony, it's an interesting mix. It really is. We come from all walks of life. If you look at the chaplaincy, it's also, no matter what the rank, there's this varied ages, varied age groups, varied ethnicities, genders. So I would say that there's a smaller handful that have come through the military in some way, shape, or form that then transfer over. Except for, here's another curveball I'll throw at you, is chaplain assistants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many chaplain assistants have thoughts or dreams about coming and serving, and then maybe later on they say, I'd like to go to school and become a chaplain. And so there's so many different ways to be called into this, but I think that's the crutch of it, is it has to be a calling.
Yeah. Is it your way, being in the military for a while and then becoming a chaplain, more typical, or is that the minority pathway that only, maybe only 10 or 15% do it?
Yeah, I wouldn't have a percentage on it, but I think you're probably warm with maybe 15%, maybe 20.
Okay.
But yeah, I think we're a smaller handful who have served in let's say a leadership role as an officer or as an NCO, and then made the leap over.
Mm-hmm. Because that's going to become important here too, because I think in terms of your career path, you've had the 12 years in the military, being an engineer, being the guy who went through boot camp and all that kind of stuff, whereas some others might not. And so that's an interesting perspective I want our listeners to remember. And now I want to go ahead and cover what a chaplain does. We got a good look at your background here, but I want to look at what a chaplain does in two different ways. First, by a quick look at what your typical day might look like. And then second, about how you approach your job through the vantage point of what I would term the soldier's life cycle, from getting off the bus day one at boot camp until he retires in the Army or even perhaps beyond. I'm not sure if you still, counsel people at the VFW or what, but we'll learn more about that. So let's just do the typical day first. And we are recording this at 8 p.m. at night because we're trying to get our schedules all set here. And you're going, I'm really busy with this OSOT or something. I didn't know what OSOT was. What's OSOT?
OSOT. Well, I said, did I say COEDOS? Is that what I said?
Maybe that was it.
Yeah. Yeah, COEDOS is a set of orders that I'm on. I've been a reserve chaplain for years. But then ever since 2006 and 2007, and that's when I met our friend Lois,
mm-hmm.
through our FRG program, she was working with them, to get a care package out to us in Iraq. But ever since 2006 and 2007, I've been activated, deployed, mobilized, and now I'm on COEDOS orders supporting the war in Afghanistan.
Okay. So you have been deployed since becoming a chaplain. What, to Iraq and Afghanistan, or one or the other?
I went to Iraq twice.
Okay, to Iraq twice. Mm-hmm. And what years were those?
2006 and 2007.
Okay.
We were deployed into Iraq, Ramadi and Fallujah with Task Force Pathfinder. And then I went over again in 2010 with a chaplain detachment, the 125th Chaplain Detachment, which is just a chaplain assistant going over to augment a unit downrange. It was the 13th ESC.
Okay. And, okay, so that gives us some good background. But you're a busy guy, so you're doing all this stuff. Give us what did you do today? I like to just take a quick slice of somebody's life, like you take a slice into a piece of cake just to see what's in there. What'd you do today? What time did you get up? Were you one of these 4 a.m. and out there marching, or what'd you do?
No, I get up usually around 6:15 and work out for about 45 minutes to an hour, and then personal hygiene, and then come in and link up with my chaplain assistants and take a look at the calendar. Today we did a lot of counseling and kind of reviewing the weekend, because we had soldiers that came back from Afghanistan this weekend. So kind of reviewing the weekend, how'd we do, what could we have done better. And then we also had Strong Bonds. I'm not sure if you've heard of the Strong Bonds marriage retreats.
No, I don't know what that is.
Mm-hmm. It's an effort on the Army's part, sponsored and run through the chaplaincy to get time for the couple together, and we call them Strong Bonds Weekends, and we work through different curriculums, whether sometimes we use Laffy Way to a Better Marriage or whatever the curriculum we're using, and just try to give couples who've been through so much in the military lifestyle, a chance to kind of breathe and focus on each other.
Yeah, that's one of these things I do want to focus on, the life cycle of a soldier, because there's a lot of family separation that occurs in the military, as well as a lot of moving around. And I know that can put a ton of stress onto relationships. So that'll be interesting. So you did that. So you got that program all set up. How many chaplain aides do you work with?
How many chaplain what?
Aides.
Chaplain assistants?
Or assistants, yeah, chaplain assistants.
Yeah, I've got, right now I'm working at the brigade level.
Okay.
So I've got two assigned to me.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And pretty young guys that are just kind of fresh into this, or who are these folks?
Yeah, one of them is, he's been in 3 years, and he came over here to support us from Germany.
Mm,
so that was his TCS move. And then the other one is, he was in the reserves for 3 years, and then he felt the call to go active duty, and he has now been assigned here. So.
Okay. So you're doing that. So a lot of meetings, I guess, and a lot of counseling goes on. I can imagine that. Is counseling almost a routine part of the job on, say, a week-to-week basis, that the bulk of your time is counseling individual soldiers or perhaps in group meetings?
It is. It is. You know, we've got, especially in the kind of a deployment cycle, there's a lot of counseling up front at the beginning, you know, when things are getting ready to change and soldiers get ready to go down range. And then throughout the middle part of the deployment, it's still there. Counseling's at an average level. It's still a constant through the week. And then typically towards the end of the deployment, counseling spikes. And all the problems that soldiers thought maybe they had swept under the rug, or maybe it had magically disappeared while they're deployed, they realize it's still there and they need some help on it. So, but yes, counseling's a strong factor in what we do.
And do you also lead religious services on Sundays or Wednesdays or whenever it might be?
Absolutely. Every chaplain in the Army, and I'll speak for here on Joint Base Lewis McChord, is to be connected to a worship service, whatever that faith group, their faith group is. And so I've been serving with, as this now, it used to be called, you know, Fort Lewis, and then we had McChord Air Force Base. And that was combined into Joint Base Lewis McChord.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been helping out the Air Force services over on McChord, their traditional and their contemporary Christian services.
Okay. All right. And your faith tradition, now you said you were growing up Presbyterian. Are you still Presbyterian now? Or?
No, I'm not. Once my wife and I got married, we settled down at a non-denominational church called Berean Bible Church in Spokane.
Okay. And does that make it easier for the military to assign you to services? You're the non-denominational guy, so you can deal with the Methodist and the Baptist and an occasional Catholic that walks by. Does that make it a little bit easier?
You know, I think it is. I think it is a good fit.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how much tension there are between the Methodist and Baptist nowadays. I know SMU and Baylor have a big rivalry going on, but, you know, if you got that non-denominational vibe going on, you can kind of bridge those gaps. Okay, so the next thing I want to do is talk through the life cycle of a soldier, and you've already hinted at some of, you know, the times that soldiers find they're in critical need of counseling, of spiritual guidance, you know, such as coming back from a deployment. They've kind of kept everything bottled up and such. But let's kind of walk through, as if I was going into the military next week and just kind of progressing through what my quote-unquote life cycle would be here. Let me know if you've had these experiences of counseling individuals, or if you know of other chaplains who have counseled them, and what some of the special things that come up. Now, we're not asking you to name names or to give special stories, but to kind of more in a general way, talk about certain issues that might be coming up at different points in a soldier's life than at other points in time. So let's go ahead and start with arriving at boot camp. And I can imagine that's going to be a pretty bumpy transitional period for any teenager or young adult to get into the military. And there's also just the stress of boot camp. You know, we've all seen the movies with, you know, a sergeant yelling at you all the time. So do you have that experience of being a chaplain's age there, looking at people's feet, I guess, or, you know, when they're putting back their boots, putting back on their boots? What goes on there?
You know, I haven't been a basic training chaplain. I've talked to some chaplains who have been there. But some of the biggest things that they're facing are, can I adapt into military lifestyle. You know, maybe they've gotten into it because of family tradition. Maybe there's different motivators that have got them to that point. Maybe they don't think that there's anything else. But there's many reasons that get them there. But all of them face, will I and can I adapt to military lifestyle? And for some, it's an immediate yes. And for others, it's more of a progress. And that's why that first week or so at basic training is so hard.
Is there any reluctance by soldiers who are in boot camp to talk to a chaplain? Because, I mean, that might signal weakness. And I can only imagine the testosterone in the first week of boot camp showing how tough you are to prove that to your sergeant that you can make it through this. Is there any reluctance? And is this something that chaplains have to be on the lookout for and saying, oh, you know, that guy's keeping it bottled up and he really shouldn't be?
Well, you know, I think that's a fantastic question because we've got to be so careful, whether it's at basic training or AIT or any places where soldiers are and chaplains are, to remember that, number one, there's absolute confidentiality.
Right.
So for a soldier to feel safe talking to a chaplain, he or she has to realize and trust that what they say will not escape our confidence, the privileged communication that they have given to us. And so that's one thing that helps them. And so is there a hesitance? I think there might be. I think there might be if someone says, who sees me going into the chaplain's office? But that's why it's so important for chaplains to be out there with their soldiers, to be out and amongst them. Because then it could just be perceived as it's a chaplain touch base. You know, hey, how are you doing today? And so that's how we kind of open the doors. Is we're with them. There's that power of with, and we call it a ministry of presence.
That's very interesting. I'm reflecting back on my time in the Boy Scouts, and I ran a summer camp for a couple of years and as the program director and worked with a chaplain there too. And that was the general strategy, is the chaplain's always walking around, and you know, kids are always reluctant to go to the chaplain, but it, you know, just stopping by and saying, hey, how's it going? Yeah. You know, just might be that door opening. I mean, they don't have to go through that door, but at points in time, they might say, yeah, hey, well, I need some spiritual guidance here. So I can imagine that it's like that. One of the next things that comes up in military lifestyle, and this is what I know from a lot of my friends who are in the military, and I look at them and with awe that they can go through the stress of moving about all the time, because you go in one place, you call, you say you're going to be out down there training in Fort Hood, but then you're going to, you know, Fort Knox, or you're going to Lewis McChord. You're moving around all the time, and it's really just hard to put down roots anywhere, and that can be stressful not only for the individual but for anybody trying to build up relations, you know, with a spouse or possibly with their families. How do you deal with the constant moving and shifting of military life?
No, that's something that, especially on the active side of the house, that everybody deals with, whether you're enlisted, officer, warrant officer. The primary change of station moves, the PCS moves. And so I've been blessed. Because, you know, I've been in the Army 22 years now, and all of it I've been reserve in some way, shape, or form, U.S. Army Reserve. But I've also been activated for, whether it's for training, activated for deployments, activated for mobilizations. So for me it's a little different, but in the aspect of from what I've experienced and also from what I've heard from fellow chaplains who move every 2 years. And I knew a chaplain who retired. He had moved 41 or 42 times.
Wow.
And he just said that he just got used to, he and his wife and the family just got used to packing and moving. And in some ways, that part is taken care of by the Army, you know, with its contracted movers. And I think they call it gypso now, where they take care of all the ins and outs of the move. But the relational part, I think, is what you're really tying this into.
Right.
And what that does outside the family unit is it makes it hard to get inside your circle of trust, you know,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, this is, in your mind, you might think this is temporary. But what it does inside the family is it can tend to tighten the family structure.
Mm.
Like, hey, it's you and I and us, and let's keep this tight because, you know, we're what we have. We're what each other has.
Does this put a lot of stress on kids, and does your mission tend to extend to helping out those kids, or for mom or dad who is in the Army, they say, hey, well, our kids are really acting up because every year they're in a different school, and how do we deal with this? Is that part of your wheelhouse?
It is, because, you know, chaplains, we provide religious support for the military and for authorized civilians, and that includes family members. And so, you know, if a soldier says, hey, chaplain, can you meet with my family? Can you meet with my 14-year-old? The answer is yes, you know. And so, again, you know, that's part of providing for the free exercise of religion, that we're one of the freedoms we fight for out of our Constitution.
Yeah. And so when you counsel with members of the family and that, are there special issues that come up with spouses or with kids, with the teenagers moving from school to school that you typically see and have to deal with?
Mm-hmm. There is with kids. Sometimes there's a sense of resentment, and maybe even a sense of abandonment, because sometimes, especially in the last decade or more, a move has been tied into a possible deployment. And so that stems up these feelings in many kids of, you know, they resent the move, perhaps, or they feel abandoned if they see their father and mother going off to an extended training or a deployment. And so those could be what we might call emotional scars.
And how do you generally deal with that? I mean, again, don't give us any specifics, but in general, if you have a 12, 14, 16-year-old who's been through these moves and mom or dad is going away for a year and it's rough, I mean, what kind of advice do you offer?
Well, I'll start by sharing a brief story with my son. I was on my second deployment, and, you know, we were getting ready to put the boys to bed, and I was putting my oldest son, Derek, to bed, and at that time, I think he was, I want to say 14, 15. And he said, and I was just a day or two away from deploying, and he said, Dad, don't go. And it just grabbed my heart. And so I just kind of was able, by the grace of God, to hold it together and kind of talk him through kind of a series of questions and some thoughts, which were, I said, Derek, why does anybody have to go? And we kind of talked through, why does anybody have to do this war on terror? And then once we realized the importance of it, and then I said, son, it's my turn. It's my turn. And he got it, and he hugged me, and we prayed. And then I went upstairs and just kind of cuddled with my wife and just bawled, you know. So no matter understanding the importance of this or not, it's hard.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
The next thing, now that you talk about that, you know, you're heading off to Iraq, and the next thing is combat deployment. And this is when we think about the Army, especially over the past decade with two ongoing wars out there in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Combat deployment is usually what everybody thinks about when it comes to it. And so you were there two times. And what are some of the special challenges of being out there in a hot field, essentially?
The challenges in general, or the challenges as a chaplain?
The challenges in general, and then how it affects you as a chaplain, and the challenges for a chaplain.
So the challenges of deployment that I've seen in general would be, number one, pulling away from your family. And the Army's not always as genteel as they could be, but I think that they're getting better at it in having different ceremonies and different send-offs, and for people to have a chance to say goodbye, and I love you, and thanks for what you're doing. And so once that's done, once the pull back from the family, once you're now at a mobile site and you're receiving training, all the getting yourself in that military mindset. So it's moving from a civilian mindset or a home front mindset, you know, into a wartime mindset or a combat mindset. And that takes some time. So the training, the extra training that goes into that, and then the time, for example, when I went to Iraq, we went through Kuwait to acclimate to the heat. And then we were there for probably 2 weeks and then went into Iraq. And I think that some of the hardest part is trying to figure out, okay, here's what I've been trained to do, but now that I'm in the war zone, my job may be totally different. And so it's adjusting over and over again, repeatedly, to what are the needs of the unit that we're with in the zone where we're at. And so, for example, cooks who've been trained to feed and provide, we had contractors over there who were doing the cooking. And so, you know, some of the cooks found themselves on guard duty.
Mm.
Yeah. And then some of the other challenges of being in a war zone for all of us was injuries.
Right.
Injuries and death. And those are the extremely hard moments. In Ramadi, when we had wounded that would come in, the loudspeakers would go off and say, clear the roads to Charlie Med, and that was our hospital. And we'd have vehicles come ripping in with wounded. And then the next thing you'd hear is extra medics get to Charlie Med. And then you'd hear whatever your blood type they needed. They didn't have storage at that time, so you, the soldiers, were the blood storage, and they'd call for B-positive blood. If you have B-positive blood, get to Charlie Med.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd use the medics to pull your blood and then use that life-saving blood to save soldiers' lives. Yeah, and so that was an example of some of the stressed moments. And then they'd call for chaplains and chaplain assistants to come up and help. So
what is that like? I think a lot of our listeners want to know what, you know, that special kind of stress, because that's normally what we think about in the military and the chaplain's aides. This is the stuff we see on the news, you know, injured soldier coming in from combat. And, I mean, are those special moments? I mean, what goes on there? Again, no specific stories, but maybe a generic story or something. What happens there?
Well, I'll tell two general situations. One was I was being trained by the chaplain I was replacing, and when they called for us to go up there, he went up there with me to Charlie Med, and it was my first day being in Charlie Med with an incident, a situation occurred, and so a tank pulled up, and they carried soldiers in, and our assistants were helping carry soldiers in, and then another tank pulled up right behind it and brought in a soldier's leg. And then that was when I realized everything that I prepped for, everything that I trained for, was for now. It was for right now. And so that was when I realized this is extremely real. It wasn't just something we trained for. And so then I started understanding where do I fit in inside this healing moment, inside this opportunity to bring a touch onto the soldier. And so the doctors then showed us where chaplains could stand, where everybody kind of would work around us, we wouldn't be in the way. And that was right by the head of the soldier, where we could talk with the soldier while they worked on him, pray with the soldier while they worked on him. And one of the most memorable situations was when we'd had a couple soldiers that were shot by sniper fire. And they were trying to stop the bleeding. He was shot just under his body armor in his stomach. And they couldn't stop the bleeding. And they said, we have to take you in for surgery right now. And he said, I want the chaplain to go with me. And I looked at the doctor and he said, scrub up, chaplain.
No.
And so we went into surgery. And it was pretty incredible.
Yeah, I can imagine that. And there's this saying that there's no atheist in foxholes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this recalls a moment that I had just as a teacher. It's nowhere near as intense or as what you ever experienced, but it was extremely impactful on my life. Was in 2004, right before the big surge into Fallujah. Mm-hmm. I had an email just come to me out of the blue. I mean, this was late October, early November of 2004, and a student just says, hi, I'm one of your students. You might not remember me. I was in one of your big classes. I came to your office hours one time, and you offered a bit of advice, and that was really good. You probably don't know who I am, but I'm about to deploy in the Fallujah, and before I go in there, I just want to say thanks. And it, for him, you know, I could sense that there was this moment that he was really taking a recounting of his life and saying, yeah, okay, what were the moments that are really important? The fact that I was even ranking in there was absolutely incredible. But
wonderful.
You know, you can see that those moments, they're very clarifying moments for people. And so do you see those battlefield conversions? Do you see people reaching out at that time? And also, do those conversions last, or are they just temporary? What your general sense of this?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there are self-proclaimed atheists in foxholes. Of course, we don't have a whole lot of foxholes anymore, but in downrange, I think there are, inside the war zone, proclaimed atheists that I would say, in my discussions with a handful, would say that they're probably more agnostic, where this process of being thrust into a wartime situation has caused them to think about life and death more than maybe they ever had before. And now the topic of, is there enough, what they're looking for is proof, or evidence. Is there enough proof or evidence to say there is a God? Or is there enough proof or evidence to say there isn't a God? And most of them will say they don't know. And so at that juncture, I would say there's probably not, in my humble opinion, any atheists. Even though they might be self-proclaimed, I believe most of them have put enough thought and time into this that they're probably more agnostic in this spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm. And do you see people with the really get that clarifying moment and say, you know, I've really thought about this now, and I need to get right with the man.
Yeah.
And how do you guide them through that?
Well, we had a situation where a soldier, even before we got into war, just the thought of going to war, he ended up spending a lot of time coming to me and my assistant, just talking about the next life. And, you know, finally we just said, you know, is this something you're curious about? And so he said yes. And I said, I can tell you from my Christian faith if you like. And he said yes. And so, and this was in Kuwait, mm-hmm. A couple of days before we launched into Iraq. And he had gone through some tough things with his wife. And so he wanted something that was stable, something that he could trust, something he could hold on to. And it ended up that was Christ. Mm-hmm. And so he did accept Christ.
Yeah. Is that fairly common, or is that a fairly rare occurrence?
Well, I would say, for me, I would say somewhat rare.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually what is happening is they've come into the military with a faith.
Okay.
They've already come in with a faith. In fact, many are Protestants and many are Catholic. And then we are in a pluralistic environment, so we also have Wiccans, Buddhists. There's a whole plethora of pluralistic faiths inside the military. And so my number one job is to provide for free exercise of religion. And so I can do that in a myriad of ways, but two main ways the chaplaincy calls perform or provide. And so I either, by the tenets of my faith, I can either perform that service. Let's say they're asking for communion.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can provide that faith by coordinating. For example, if a Wiccan was asking me to do something for him, well, no, I can't do that for you, but I can coordinate for a Wiccan lay leader to help you. And so it's a very delicate balancing act, but taking care of the individual soldier and his or her faith needs and religious needs are so important.
Yeah. No, that was one of the questions I was going to ask later on, because I know there's a lot of different people of different faith traditions. And mm-hmm. and so, yeah, you just help coordinate and our, I guess, our very understanding in terms of how you do that.
Yeah. So, for example, I had a Catholic soldier came to me, and he always called me Padre. And I made sure he knew that I wasn't Catholic. And he said, well, I still want to call you Padre. I said, that's fine. But when he needed a Catholic priest to give confession to, I walked him over to the Catholic priest in Ramadi and took care of him.
Mm-hmm. And how is it between, you know, the different chaplains of different faiths there? I mean, you're a pretty strong community and you coordinate very well.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I've noticed that inside our Catholic group, I like our Catholic, inside our chaplaincy, there's such a camaraderie, you know. Sometimes that's not the case, you know, just like in any organization, there's some good eggs and bad eggs, but in general, such a camaraderie and that we're working together for something holy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you guys ever do joint ecumenical services? You get together and say, hey, you know, on Thursday, this, you know, second Thursday of the month, we're all going to get together for a prayer session and just put aside our theological differences and just give praise?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, downrange, sometimes we do the ecumenical prayer breakfast where chaplains of different faiths were all supporting it. Back here, I was actually part of an ecumenical push back here where we worked for the youth. The youth ministry here on base, and it's an ecumenical youth ministry.
Yeah.
And so that's something, and sometimes on, let's say, the remembrance of 9/11, we'll do an ecumenical service of remembrance where everybody's welcome to come.
Mm-hmm.
So important to remember we're in this together.
Let me ask about issues of returning home, because that's where you said that there's a lot of need for chaplain services, that you've been out in field for a year, and a lot of things change. I mean, a lot of things change with relationships, with spouses. I mean, soldiers go through a lot of different changes. Who they enter when they go out on deployment is they're a much different person when they come back.
Yeah.
What kind of special challenges of coming home do you face, and how do you deal with them?
Well, depending on where the soldier's gone, what they've done, what they've seen, it can be, on a scale of 1 to 10, it could be a 2 for them, you know, 2 being the lightest, and maybe, or it could be an 8, with 10 being the worst.
Mm-hmm.
But in, no matter what they've seen, no matter what they've done, they're coming back different. Just being away from home for a year, even if they had, you know, not left the States, a year changes people. And so part of that for us is saying, reminding the soldier, hey, when you left, maybe in your mind you hit the pause button. And your family's been back here, just paused, waiting for you to come back. And so we really try to help them understand, you've changed. Well, guess what? So is your family. And so inside this reunion and in this process of reintegrating, you have to learn the changes. And you can't expect to come back and step into the picture and hit play like nothing has happened. And this is one of the biggest things that people, not just soldiers, but people struggle with, is change.
There's another aspect of change that occurs in a soldier's life, too, and this usually comes at retirement, and it comes at different ages for different people. Some people, you know, put in their minimum time and they're out the door. Other people make a very long career of it, but at some point in time, you take the step off the military base. Now, you said you're in the reserve, so do you have a separate position or a job in the civilian world that you work at, or?
I do. I was working as a youth counselor for many years.
Okay.
Working with troubled teens, but then I also moved into the sheriff chaplaincy.
Okay.
So supporting the Spokane County Sheriff chaplaincy has been a joy for me, really. But I've been away from there because I've been stationed at Joint Base Lewis McChord for 2.5 years now.
Yeah, but you have some foot out there in the civilian world, and I'm wondering if that gives you any special insight. Is it a difficult time for some? You know, people say, I've spent 4 or 5 years in the military, or I've spent 25 or 30 years in the military. Now I got to go in the civilian world. That's got to be a big, big shift.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right. And I think once I hit the 4-year mark, or even the 8-year, maybe Tony, anything under 8, to them, they're like, you know, this was just a blip. This is just a blip on the radar. And then they get out and they are either thankful or not thankful for their experience, but it doesn't have a jarring effect on them. But I'll tell you what, anything after that 8 or 10 year mark, boy, it's not just a blip in the radar. It's now maybe an identity. It's kind of, in many cases, who they are. It's not I do the soldiering thing. I am a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's really embedded into their identity for many people. Even though they might say, I can't wait to retire, you see more and more, not just because of the bad economy, but you see more and more people hit that 20 and then they stay.
Yeah.
Well, why do they stay? Right?
Yeah.
You know, it's part of their identity. It's part of who they are now. And so, you know, we do, as Army chaplains, we do suicide awareness briefings all the time. And one of the identifiers that we say we need to be helping people watch out for is the spike in suicide in many different areas, including the one you asked about, retirement. Yeah, it's a trigger for many people, a risk factor for the potential for suicide if it's not addressed and talked about.
And that's interesting that you notice, because there has been talk in the media recently about suicides in the military, and we oftentimes think they're associated with deployments or coming home from a deployment, and the family is so much different. But yeah, just that whole, I've been in 20 years and now I'm leaving. What is that new world? I mean, that's, yeah. you're much older, and both of us are roughly the same age. I'm a little bit older than you, but yeah, we don't adjust to change very well when we're older, you know?
Yeah, like, what's next for me, and yeah. What do I do, and can I do it? And even though all these wonderful gifts and strengths that the Army's given us, sometimes there's some fear about how that is going to be reapplied in the civilian life.
Do you offer counseling to former soldiers? I mean, do you hang out at the VFW post and see if anybody needs help, or do people come stop back at the Joint Base Lewis McChord and say, "Hey, you remember me? I retired 2 years ago, but boy, I could use some counseling now."
You know, we often get invitations to do invocations or benedictions at different events, VFW events, different retiree events, and so at those moments, there's wonderful opportunities to listen to people, to share, and then the surprising moments where we get to reconnect with soldiers that we knew who were in the military.
Mm-hmm. And you maintain those bonds over time? A number of people stick with you for a while?
You know, it's amazing how maybe in the military you haven't spoken to somebody in maybe over a year, maybe over 2 years, Tony, and you get 5 minutes with somebody, and it all comes back, especially if you deployed with them.
Mm-hmm.
It all comes back in a heartbeat. There's a brotherhood and a connection that just surpasses anything I could really explain.
I have two more questions I want to leave off with as our time is starting to draw near here. You just mentioned the brotherhood that you feel, especially with deployment and that. And one of the things that I know, and I've talked to many pastors and chaplains and a number of different arenas, one thing that always amazes me is how much burden that chaplains bear. I mean, they, you know, when people are happy, you know, they might share it with you sometimes, right? Oh, hey, chaplain, you know, guess what? I just got promotion. You're like, yay, and that. But a lot of the work you do is counseling during the hard times, during the troubled times. And just for any human being, no matter how deep in faith you may be, sometimes that's a very heavy burden to bear. You're bearing the burdens of a lot of other people. It's a very emotional and difficult job that you have. Does the military or the chaplaincy service on their own provide any support for yourselves? I mean, chaplains need chaplains, essentially.
Who pastors the pastor? Who chaplains the chaplain?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I would say that there's a lot more resources today for soldiers than there ever has been. Now, for chaplains, it's probably a little less, and maybe it's our own doing. Maybe mm-hmm. it's our own doing. Maybe there are chaplains that maybe say, hey, I shouldn't need help because I'm the helper. But the truth is we do. And one of the things that we need to be careful of as chaplains is what we call compassion fatigue, where we could be giving, 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 and never refilling. And then eventually we burn out. And the term compassion fatigue is real. I've seen it in fellow chaplains downrange.
How do you deal with that? I mean, are you watching out for one another? Or do you, you know, you see one of your fellow chaplains or even a chaplain's aide saying, well, you guys, you know, you're looking pretty down. Can we help? Or how do you deal with them?
Yeah, we do. We do watch out for each other. And I had a fellow chaplain downrange, and when he would have bad times in his unit or be overwhelmed, he'd come over and just sit in my office. And he would just kind of decompress, be in my office for maybe an hour, and we'd talk and pray and maybe get some laughs in even.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd be like, okay, I can go back. And then he'd offer the same for me.
Yeah.
And so we learned how to carry this together. And I think that's important for all of us to realize in the military and otherwise, who's on your team, who's part of your support group, and don't be ashamed to ask for help.
Mm-hmm. And it can oftentimes be a very difficult thing, especially as you mentioned, if you're the helper, to be asking for help, you know, again, just like in boot camp, you try to man up, just like in the chaplaincy service, you try to spiritual up and say, I can handle it myself, but we can't go through this alone. So,
no. Well, one of the terms that kind of rhymes with what you're saying is suck it up, and
yeah.
That's an old Army term.
Yeah.
Suck it up, and they even try to make a joke out of it and say, suck it up, buttercup, but, you know, the truth is, suck it up Tony, is not working anymore. It's not working. And so we need to figure a better way to carry this. And if we as the caregivers can't do it, you know, then what are we doing? And so I think about how we encourage people that they're not just physical, they're not just emotional, but they're also spiritual. And that's sometimes that faith, whatever their faith background is, whatever their faith is, what they put their beliefs in, that can be the glue that helps hold them all together. And so who do they talk to about that? You know, and hopefully they have a chaplain they trust and they can talk to about that. They could say, for example, sometimes I'll use 1 Peter 5:7 and say, cast all your cares upon Him, God, for He cares for you. And it starts to take us out of our, sometimes we get into our own world and we forget about the bigger picture. And so we need that bigger picture of who's on your support team, who's got your back, and who can you trust.
The next question I want to ask you, and in part you have a foot in the civilian world. Now you've been at JBLM, Joint Base Lewis McChord. I can use acronyms here every so often. You've been there for a couple of years now, but again, you were a youth counselor out there in Spokane. You work with the sheriff's department, and a lot of sheriffs are oftentimes former military guys too. And I don't know how long you plan on doing this. If you plan on going to up to age 65 and as a chaplain on reserve, but at some point in time, you're back in the civilian world. Is there anything that you take from your experience as a chaplain in the military to the civilian world? Does it change the way you deal with some of these kids, with sheriffs, with your other experiences? And if so, what is that?
Well, let me answer the first question. What will I take? Tony, if I'm smart, I'll take everything. Because this experience has been so full and so ripe and so challenging and so sweet, all mixed up into one. And if I'm wise, I'll take everything that the military has taught me, good, bad, and ugly, and take it with me wherever I go. And then what was the other part of your question?
I guess, how do you translate that to individuals in the civilian world? I mean, you're working with kids who are not in the military, or yeah, might be working with sheriffs who haven't been in the military. I mean, what lessons can you give them from your experiences?
Absolutely. Empathy. If I've avoided compassion fatigue, and Tony, if I've been able to avoid burnout, and by the grace of God I have so far, then and only then can I say, I believe that someone who's been through this, not just a chaplain, but people who've been through these experiences, life and death experiences, that we can bring an empathy and a compassion and an understanding to the human equation that perhaps nobody else can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a good lesson to take. All right, one final question here before we leave. You've been in the military and the Army specifically for, you know, 20-plus years now, 22, 23 years or so, and you're a chaplain. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to football, does God like the Army or the Navy more?
Did you ever see the movie Angels in the Outfield?
No, I did not.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, it's a wonderful show, and one of the quotes out of the show was, God doesn't decide games.
Okay. I guess that's a safe one, because you probably have to counsel some Navy sailors every so often.
I do. I was deployed with the Marines.
Yeah.
Interesting task force. So, but I would say I cheer personally for the Army.
Okay. Yeah. And your dad was in the Navy, so you got to be very, very cool. You can't lose on that one, though.
Nope.
So.
Nope.
But anyways, it has been an absolute joy talking to you, Chaplain Canoon, Robert, and I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Hallelujah. Thank you, Tony, for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.